for the love of language.
For the love of language. For the love of language.
Kate, Tonya, an easy one to start with. Kate, what is language?
Well, that's a straightforward question. Yes. What is language? What is human language, you mean?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I guess you could say it's a communication system that differs vastly from animal communication. I know you think your dog talks,
I do,
Peter, but I think you'll find that our language is vastly different.
We'll come back to the animal language in a moment, but let's dig further into what language actually is. And I guess my way of trying to imagine it is the very first humans starting to use language. Someone goes over the hill, they come back, and of course the rest of the group wants to know what was over the hill. What are the fundamental biological drivers for creating language in the first place?
There was co-evolution going on when language was developing, because not only did we have to have the articulatory physiology that we have to be able to produce speech sounds, but we also had to be developing particular kinds of ways of relating socially, and there were impacts psychologically. We had to be able to do certain kinds of thinking. So that whole process is quite complex. And if you go over the hill and then you come back, one of the important things that other people in your social group want to do is say hello, really. And obviously people want to know what happened over the hill.
So that's events.
Maybe there's something you know about over the hill now that would be in other people's interest to know too. There's power tied up in the way that language communicates information. You can tell and you can not tell, and both of those things can be powerful things to do. Just information has power attached to it, really.
Kate, later on we're going to be talking about storytelling. My impression is that when I hear other humans using language in a general sense, it's nearly always a narrative. It's nearly always some form of story.
Story, that's right. Yeah, who did what to whom and what we were all thinking at the time and yes.
And when it was.
Yes.
And how long it took.
Mm-hmm.
All those things.
And our language is also full of those approximating kind of phrases, like kind of, sort of. I've been looking at a bit in Australian English recently. And we have those, I think, because of this kind of mismatch, I think, between what's going on in our heads and the rather inadequate resources, our linguistic resources for communicating those thoughts and those feelings.
Is it clear then to all of us that there are some fundamental biological drivers for the beginning of language, which we're trying to imagine right back in the mists of time, but still really clear today that there are an identifiable number of drivers for our use of language?
Well, I guess for me, one of the interesting things about the way that people live in Western societies, you can go around with the illusion that you're very independent. But when you live in a community that's got less sort of physical infrastructure around it, it's very clear that human beings don't survive without relationships. And to me, the fundamental driver for language is about establishing and maintaining relationships. Actually, it's very hard to survive as a human being without connections to other people. In a modern Western society, that tips over into being able to negotiate with online systems. That takes a lot of high linguistic skill to be able to navigate your bank statement, the Centrelink payment requirements and whatever. And those things are all about language.
Kate, you and I both know the play and the film, Kaspar Hauser. It's the story of a boy who was kept in a dark room for a long time, cut off from exactly what Tonya was talking about. We can also imagine the contrast of a young baby in the crib on the first few days of life being cooed over and starting to babble very soon and start trying to mimic and imitate parents and visitors. Language just descends upon them. So reflect on those two contrasting situations. If you're cut off from other humans, does language just wither and die?
You don't develop language, and there are quite a few cases of humans, awful cases, where they have been brought up in isolation or not communicating with another human being, and it doesn't happen. Language doesn't happen. And there's that what's sometimes called a critical learning period. So if you don't acquire language in that time frame, then you never really acquire full competence.
Now, I noticed, linguist, and you're very firm on this, back to the animals, my dog does make lots of noises. And we think there's an intonation pattern there that even imitates some of our intonations. Perhaps we're projecting. I guess you think we do. But I know from studying various forms of animal behaviour, the meerkats have different, really clear identifiable different sounds to always talk about an eagle, a snake, another group of meerkats approaching. They do have a what we might loosely call a vocabulary. Why so strict between humans and animals?
it does, of course, depend on your definition of language a lot of the time.
Which is what
I'm
going for.
Yes, that's right. But there are fundamental differences, it seems, between human communication and animal communication. Of course, you know, we might well just be scratching the surface of dolphin speak, for example, and not really understand meerkat language.
Whale songs.
Exactly. However, no animal communication system, as far as we know, has that what's sometimes called a duality of patterns, with this infinite use of finite means. So you've got a finite set of sounds which combine to form these parts of words, which then combine to form an infinite number of words, which then combine to form an infinite number of phrases. And so you've got this kind of hierarchical structure, which is absent from animal communication. Some animals have, yes, I think it's right, impressive repertoires, but they seem to be fixed.
Our dogs have vocalizations, and they have quite a limited range of purposes that they use them for. There might be different vocalizations for snake, for meerkats in different communities, but I'd put money on the idea that probably they were all going, hey, there's a snake, watch out. And it's not, remember that snake we saw last week. So I think there's sort of constraints on what other creatures can do with language compared with what people do with language.
Because we could talk about imaginary things. Tooth fairy, Father Christmas.
One of the aspects of language which we just take for granted today is that we can move it around in time via writing, printing, alphabets, forms of symbolism. But the long history of language is, of course, as an oral, a spoken language. Mm-hmm. How important is that to the whole evolution of language, even as we use it today?
Speech is primary. I mean, it's very hard for us to realise that, I think, because we are so up to our necks in writing these days. We do tend to People generally tend to look at language through the spectacles of writing. But of course, writing is an optional extra. I mean, it's a gorgeous optional extra and it's incredibly important. But bear in mind, I think it's still the case that the majority of the world's languages are unwritten. Yes, speech is natural as sitting upright. It's acquired that way.
The baby babbling. Each culture explores what those range of sounds might be able to do in terms of communicating. Is that how it works?
Babies, when they start babbling, will babble all sorts of sounds.
All the sounds.
All the sounds. And then they'll gradually sort of home in on the sounds that are clearly important.
The useful ones.
Yes, that's right.
Because exactly. They get a response.
Exactly.
They're understood.
Yes.
An interesting thing about that is just the way that babies' mouths, when they're infants, are actually structured quite differently from adult mouths. And they're structured to support sucking so that they can get milk. And so actually quite a good number of the sounds that adults produce, babies can't produce. They need to lose their cheek pads to have a different shape of mouth, and they need teeth to be able to make the full range of adult sounds.
Tonya and Kate, we're going to delve in much more deeply to the spoken language and the sounds of language in later podcasts in this series. We're going to be talking about words, obviously, and words sit almost centrally in our language. But there are a lot of nonverbal aspects of spoken language, like intonation and pace and loudness. Are they biological as well? Are they something that are discovered, that are different ways of encoding meaning within language?
Certainly intonation patterns are the first things that are acquired by babies, so they will be imitating intonation patterns extremely early. And if you think of former bilingual communities, sometimes an intonation pattern is all that's left of the fact that there was another language spoken there, because the remaining language might have a very distinctive intonation pattern. So it's embedded, it's laid down, it's one of the sort of deeply anchored features of language.
Because, Tony, what I'm wondering is whether those oral add-ons, if you like, the intonations, the stress patterns, all that that we use as well as the words and the structures, whether they're fundamentally biological as well.
It's interesting because clearly they're coming out of our physical bodies. So on some level, they are obviously connected to our biology. It's also true that they're quite culturally mediated. So for example, in Australian English and increasingly in other contexts, in New Zealand English, there's this thing called the high-rising terminal where people go up at the end because they're expressing a sort of desire for connection and a sort of checking in. There are other parts of the English-speaking world where that high-rising terminal is not established or is a later kind of development. And in those contexts, the high-rising terminal is not judged in a positive way. And that tells you that although the high-rising terminal may have some sort of physiological connection, it's also highly cultural and often actually quite gendered as well. But the gender is not the biology that's causing the meaning. The meaning is coming from the culture.
Can we say, as a general pattern, there are a whole lot of things available to the human to communicate with, essentially sounds, speech. There are cultural forces at work to guide and modulate those choices. Is that what's happening at a very fundamental level?
Yes.
I think that's a fair summary, yeah.
And, of course, in written language, increasingly, particularly as we've now got electronic communication, which is, well, depending on how you want to describe it, it's somewhere in between speech and writing, but it tries to put all of those things that you've been describing, the fact that your eyebrows are going up and down as you're speaking, into that written mode.
And your hands are waving about.
That's right. Yes. Even though no one can see them, you know, who's listening to this podcast.
But gesture is important, isn't it?
Almost certainly. Discussions of emoji, for example, these days, they're treating the emoji as gestural aspects of language.
I'm watching your gestures now and you're using it for emphasis, but I think you're also guiding your speech with your gestures as well. And if you squeeze your hand tightly, you'll sound different
yes.
compared to if you have an open palm.
Oh, that's interesting, yes.
And, of course, by watching gestures, they sometimes convey tense as well. That was then, this is now, the way we use our hands mm-hmm. to produce aspects of weight even.
There's signed languages where the face and the hands and the body become the tools for expressing signs in much the same way that words are signs and in the same way that words written down become signs as well. So in some ways, from a linguistic perspective, what's important is the existence of the signs and the ways the signs can be recombined.
We've got the sign and we've got the pronunciation and meaning that's attached there, but each are free to go down its own path. So what happens is, of course, that pronunciation can change and meanings can change vastly. And given a long enough period of time, words can even come to mean the opposite of what they once meant. So certainly they are free to change.
But a lot of it's very arbitrary, and that's kind of weird in its own way, isn't it? That we're so used to having language and meaning and nuance and subtlety and connotations and denotations, which we'll talk about later. Take us a little bit further on this idea of the arbitrary use of signs in language.
In English, the word for a dog is dog, but in Mali, a language spoken in Papua New Guinea, the word for a dog is vaimga. There's nothing about a dog that makes one of those sets of sounds more necessary than another, and I'm sure between us we could come up with the word for dog in many other languages.
It also doesn't stop humans from looking for some sort of connection,
That's
does it?
True.
And so humans are always on the lookout for some sort of meaningful connection. So you do wonder whether, you know, Shakespeare was right, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. However, the rose does seem like a very beautiful word, and we start putting meanings into that. And of course, that's why advertisers spend thousands and thousands of dollars with the right assemblage of consonants and vowels to kind of implant desire in the minds of possible consumers.
So sounds aren't necessarily arbitrary, and words that rely on those kinds of symbolic associations we have to sounds carry all of those
yes.
implicit meanings with them.
It's well recognised in advertising. You mentioned advertising, the k-k sound, Kellogg's cornflakes, Coca-Cola, etc. Perhaps it's got a way of just scraping its little way into your mind.
Yes, it's compactness, isn't it, is what those stopped sounds connote.
What about those non-word words, if you like ug and
eeeh
and those sort of sounds? They're not straight words, but they are sounds that sort of a bit like words.
And they certainly enter the language as words. I mean, a word like burp entered English exactly that way. So it was supposed to be some sort of representation of the sound that we make. And then, of course, it gets its own spelling and it starts to look a reasonable way of representing that sound that we make when we've got a bit of indigestion.
I very much enjoy when people sneeze and they do at you on their way out with the sneeze.
Yes, yes, with the actual, yes.
They make a word out of their sneeze.
Yeah. Yes. Or we say tisk tisk, you know, which was supposed to be the representation of that click sound of disapproval.
And now we go tisk tisk.
Yes, yes.
There's a bit of that goes on, actually. Let's finish this podcast with this reflection. The word creativity, it's been implicit in everything we've said, that humans are intensely creative with the way they put language together and they create all those meanings and meanings upon meanings. Kate, is creativity just inevitably part of language change?
Almost certainly. Just that aspect of creativity, the sort of playing with language, most certainly. We all love to play with language, but that is also a fundamental aspect of human communication, is that creative aspect that we talked about earlier. So this, again, you know, infinite use of a finite means. So that Steven Pinker makes this point where he says, you know, there's sort of no limit to the number of words that we can make. And he gives the example of what's that really long word in the English language? Flotchy, nouchy, nihilipilification, which is the act of estimating something as being worthless. So as he says, well, you can put an AL on that, flotchy, nouchy, nihilipilificational, or flotchy, nouchy, nihilipilificationalization, you know. And you can keep adding endings, even in a language like English that doesn't have much in the way of endings or prefixes. And there's no limit. I mean, there's a practical limit. You're all going to get really cheesed off with me if I keep doing that. But there's no actual limit.
Tony, hearing Kate talk about that, it makes me think that all of us make our language our own.
There's a way that we tell stories at the dinner table in my family that if I thought about, I could probably write a recipe for, you know. And actually, when I get a laugh using that recipe with my family, I feel immensely pleased with myself. It's not just that language is creating itself when people use the means available to make more language, but also we're creating ourselves socially through language.
There is that aspect of creativity, or we make a big deal in linguistics about creativity, but when linguists actually look at the sorts of things that people say, we actually don't come up with much that's new, that we do have, touched on then, Tonya, the kind of personal routines that, I mean, one estimation was something like 70% of what comes out of our mouths is actually fairly formulaic. I mean, we have our own personal routines. There are ones that exist in the language, but we use those as a kind of basis to then be a bit more creative on top of that. The one analogy that used to be used was, you know, language is a game, and how can you keep playing that chess game while the rules are shifting all the time? But of course, what fundamental aspect of that change is variation, and that's an important part of language, is the variation and how we use that for social meaning. So if you see variation as part of the system, then there's no problem.
Until next time.
For the love of language.